and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, December 20th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. Well, it's hard to believe, but it's already time to say goodbye to 2024 and ring in a new year. Before we do, however, we'd like to take the next half hour to review some of our favorite interviews of this year. It's become a bit of a tradition at Rabble Radio, after all. Will your favorite interview make it on the list? Be sure to let us know over social media which episode spoke to you the most this year and who you're hoping to hear on Rabble Radio in the year to come. Now, without further ado, let's dive into the top Rabble Radio interviews of 2024. In January, then Jack Layton Journalism for Change fellow Madison Edward Wright sat down with associate professor at Concordia University, Ted Rutland, to talk about his work on anti-Black racism and policing in Canada, specifically in Montreal. In this clip, Rutland will take us through a brief history of policing in Quebec and give us a temperature check of the situation as it is today.
There's been a struggle against the police going back to, you know, the formation of the police department itself in the late 1800s. And, you know, prior to the creation of the police department, there are things like policing. Like, you have military officials doing surveillance, you have courts that punish people, etc. And, you know, the formation of the police, courts, and prisons is very much bound up with settler colonialism. And so the attacks through the criminal justice system on Indigenous people, their displacement from the island of Montreal in the 1700s, special laws that apply only to Indigenous people, like laws against consuming alcohol, being in a tavern. All of that apparatus is built up to control enslaved Black people who sometimes commit the grave crime of being free, which is a very particular crime that only applies to enslaved people, obviously, and very much tied to the control of working class people when industrial capitalism emerges. And so, you know, in the late 1800s, something like 80% of the people in the Montreal jail were Irish Catholics imprisoned for disorderly conduct or being drunk, you know. So, you know, you're really trying to control working class people, keep them disciplined so that they'll go to work, they won't strike, they won't expend excess energy by, you know, enjoying themselves after work. And that carries right into the present. And when the city really started to change, as cities across North America and around the First World started to change in the 70s and 80s, with the sort of transition away from industrial capitalism towards a kind of tech or knowledge capitalism, and with changing immigration patterns where, you know, there's an end in the 1960s to Canada's white-only immigration policy, cities start to become more diverse. And violence against Black communities becomes much more prevalent, which doesn't mean it wasn't always there. It's just the Black community gets larger. And so quantitatively, there's more violence against Black people. And there's been a struggle against the police. You know, the first time that I found that people were distinctly calling for a paring back of police was in 1979, after the brutal police beating of a bunch of Haitian soccer players in the neighborhood of St. Michel. So there's ongoing discussion about how to deal with police racism and violence. And a lot of times those discussions, unfortunately, have been centered on things like multicultural training, building relationships with communities, like winning the trust of communities, hiring more diverse cops, etc., none of which changes anything, or at least does a positive. And there's always been a discussion about defunding the police, not necessarily with using that term. So since 2020, when George Floyd and Breonna Taylor were killed, we have this second wave of the Black Lives Matter movement, which begins in the United States but carries into Canada. And people in Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, Ottawa, everywhere, they see the connections between the movement in the United States and their own struggles. And so there was a very widespread and vibrant movement to defund the police. In a survey that the city took, 73% of Montrealers were in support of defunding the police. And the city government didn't do it. And so The relationship between the police and the city is twofold. One is that I think there's a widespread resistance to the police in Montreal among people. I mean, we have the lowest level of confidence in the police of anywhere in Canada. We don't have confidence in the police. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we're radical, you know, just means we don't see it as a corrupt and harmful institution. And some of those people who don't trust them would like to see it reformed, but some of them would like to see it defunded, alternatives supported instead. But unfortunately, you know, the city government is dominated by two political parties, Projet Montréal, which is like a city-based, like an urban-based liberal party. And then we have Ensemble Montréal, which is a suburban-based, more conservative party. And so neither of those parties are willing to support anything that has to do with racial justice, anything that has to do with, you know, real social justice, and they're not going to do anything about the police, and they have not. They've funded the police. They've increased police funding more since 2020 than before 2020, and more than anywhere else in Canada. You know, we have this convergence between an urban liberal party and a suburban conservative party that just continues to throw money at the police.
At the end of her term as the Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow in 2023, Kia Lucero covered the Kearl Mine tailings leak and how the Alberta Energy Regulator and Imperial Oil both failed to report those leaks for a disastrous 9-month period. Brandy Morin, an award-winning Cree, Iroquois, French journalist, released Killer Water, a documentary which shines a light on the environmental impacts of Alberta's oil sands industry. Morin shares with Lucero in this clip the grave ways the community of Fort Chipewyan has been impacted by the Kearl Mine tailings leak.
You know, something that I was really stunned by when I was there in person, because, you know, for years I had heard about people being sick, people being concerned about the pollution in the water, in the air from the oil sands industry. But when I was actually on the ground and talking with people in the community, I was stunned by how many people that were sick, how many people whose relatives or cousins or, you know, friends either had passed away of cancer, were fighting cancer, or dealing, you know, with a type of sickness. And that this is just such a small, remote community of like about 1,200 people, and such a high amount of the population was sick. And even when I was visiting people around the town who I was meeting and such, and didn't know what I was there for, that I was there reporting on the issue, they would just bring it up and being like, yeah, well, you know, we have our beautiful territory here and we love it. And, but yet it's poison. And I was just so stunned. I was stunned by the amount of children that I was hearing about that, you know, that were sick. And so it's one thing to hear about it and another to take it in, you know, when you're actually on the ground. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear in the community that people have. You know, these are people that are still connected to their culture and their traditional ways, and they go out on the land a lot, and they have bush cabins along the river, you know, for, you know, hundreds of kilometers around the area, and they harvest meat and medicines. But, you know, they're in this place of questioning whether it's safe, you know, to consume their medicines and the meat that they're hunting. And it's just, it's, you know, it was really striking to, you know, to see how afraid and confused everybody is, but also how they really want to hang on to their traditional ways, because the land and the water to them, with who they are as either Dene or Cree or Métis, is one and the same, right? So those are some of the things that I've seen. And then I've seen physical, impacts. I would see oil sheens all over the place and on the shore, or, you know, we went for several hours upriver from Fort Chipewyan, and, you know, the river just looks like a soup of contaminants. And I'm not an expert, but what I seen there disturbed me in regards to the various foam and oil sheens and different liquids that were churning and floating in this river system. And the people that use the river system how they would tell me that it was not normal that they had used these river systems for many years, and how they were seeing it change and seeing these new substances pop up and being very concerned about it.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think that that's like a common theme that's brought up and sentiment that's brought up by your sources and the people you interviewed in Killer Water. I feel like last year when that was unveiled, the Imperial Crow Mine tailings spill, a lot of the public were shocked. But it seems like the Athabascan Chipewyan First Nation, they have known about this for years, and they have suspected it for years. And they have suspected that industry had been kind of pulling the wool over their eyes.
Absolutely. You know, one of the people that I interviewed in my documentary is Dr. John O'Connor. Now, he had worked in Fort Chipewyan as a physician for a couple of decades and, you know, started back in the 80s, 90s. And then when he started treating people that were showing up with patterns of sickness and getting rare types of cancers, he started to be really concerned and started to look into what could be causing that. And he knew, and others in the community of Fort Chipewyan in general, which consists of Athabasca, Chipewyan First Nation, Miccosukee Cree, and Métis, you know, they had known about spills and contaminants, not only in the river system, but in the air. And then, you know, also the plants and the food chains, right, that all are connected together, and had been trying to raise the alarm for years, but weren't taken seriously.
It's a great interview, and we hate to cut it off there, as with all the clips today. So if you like what you hear and haven't given the full episode a listen already this year, or perhaps you want to revisit these conversations, we encourage you to queue up these episodes after you're done listening to this episode. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and Rabble.ca. Now, back to the clips. May is Asian Heritage Month in Canada, and this year we were very excited to share with our listeners a two-part discussion on the history of Asian labor in Canada. Kia Lucero sat down with Patricia Chong and Corrine Ng of the Ontario and BC branches of the Asian Canadian Labor Alliance. In this clip, we'll hear them dive into the concept of a model minority and explain how all racial justice fights are intertwined.
So in addressing an intersectional approach in confronting anti-Asian racism and how it links to other forms of oppression, I think Carol Wall, who passed away about a year ago, was a great advocate involved with the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. And she spoke at the Toronto Solidarity Rally against anti-Asian racism in 2021. So this was in the peak of COVID. And she said this to the crowd. She said, "We end anti-Asian racism when we abolish white supremacy. We end anti-Indigenous racism when we abolish white supremacy. We end anti-Black racism when we abolish white supremacy." And she identified herself as an abolitionist, because she believed the abolitionist project was not finished, and we needed to take up actions against that and identify as abolitionists. And so the idea specifically with anti-Asian racism was trying to find a way to address anti-Asian racism within a bigger context of white supremacy. And I think that's what Carol Wall was getting at in terms of that quote. And this idea that how do we go from, as Corrine mentioned, 1907, where the Vancouver Labor Council is actively campaigning for a riot, where we were once seen as a threat, as unclean, as more, you know, opium dens, threats to morality, threat to the thread of Canada. How do we go from that in 1907 to being considered a quote-unquote model minority in a very quick amount of time? It's actually quite fascinating to think of those that character changing over time. And I think one of the reasons this has been able to happen is that with Blacks being freed as slaves, as being emancipated, technically speaking, with Indigenous people being quote-unquote granted the same rights as everyone else, you have, again, white supremacy moving the chess pieces on the chessboard in order to uphold white supremacy. And the role that Asians, and I say Asians broadly, you can't see my quotation marks, but my Asians broadly, is that we play the model minority role. And the idea, and people are, you're nodding your heads, the idea is that we were held up as and continue to be held up as a model, in the sense that if you were industrious enough, if you worked hard enough, if you were quote unquote smart enough, you could succeed in the Canadian dream, in the American dream, and have class mobilization. However, as quote unquote Asians were held up as a model, which then means that if there's a model, there must be a opposite to the model, a failing, a moral failing, a working failing. And so Asians are upheld on one hand as a reason for success, while at the same time pushing down Indigenous people, Black people, by saying on the flip side, well, if only you worked harder, if only you were smarter, if only you were A, B, and C, you would have the upward social mobility that the Asians have. Of course, we know that's not true. Asians is not a hegemonic group. It's very varied, but that doesn't matter to this myth. And so in less than 100 years, you have this complete change, which I think is fascinating. And when I visited the Museum of Chinese History in the United States, they had a picture of the model minority, and the idea of that term being popularized in the United States in the 1960s, just as the American Civil Rights Movement is beginning to take hold. So you can see, again, white supremacy kind of, like I said, changing the pieces of the chessboard, so they're able to maintain it. And of course, as Asian people, we also have to question ourselves, at the expense of whom have we been able to rise, if at all? And also, in what ways have our parents, have our grandparents also accepted white supremacy, in the sense that, yeah, we're not white, we're close enough, at least we're not Black, at least we're not Indigenous. And then of course, the racial hierarchy there. And how do we play into that?
And I'm really happy you brought up the model minority myth, because I know that's something that is very entrenched in kind of Asian Canadian labor and just being Asian in general in Canada and so-called Canada. Corinne, would you like to add anything to that?
This is great. Like, I don't want to repeat anything. I would only add that, you know, this participation in the settler colonial project of, you know, making of Canada and maintaining of colonial Canada. Like, another thing I think that we have to name, other than white supremacy, is capitalism, right? Like, you know, this model minority, at the root of it, is based on competition and a hierarchy, as Patricia mentioned. And all of that, right? Like, that's a blueprint of capitalism. We know that there is an inherent hypocrisy within capitalism, that, you know, as long as you work hard enough, it's as though we're equal to begin with, and we are in a competition. And we kind of accept those assumptions a lot of times without questioning, but are we equal to begin with, to start with? And do we believe in competition? So I think those are important questions to ponder, given that we are living and working and, you know, deriving our sustenance. We're breathing the air and, you know, walking on the land and drinking the water, you know, of Turtle Island, which, you know, has been stewarded and protected for us by folks here, you know, that have been here since time immemorial. You know, like, what are the ethical and moral implications of us being here and participating in this, you know, capitalist extractive and highly exploitative system that pits us against each other?
This year, a major win for the pro-choice movement, and indeed a win for women's health across Canada, came in the form of an announcement by the Liberal federal government that crisis pregnancy centers and charities must now clearly reveal to their clients whether they offer abortion or abortion referrals. This new policy will prevent anti-choice pregnancy centers from misleading women to try to deter them from having an abortion. In the months leading up to this policy being announced, Joyce Arthur, the founder and executive director of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada, joined Rabble editor Nick Seabrook to talk about belief-based denial of care and the state of abortion rights in Canada. Take a listen.
Belief-based denial of care. Can you tell us about what that is? Sure. People might be more familiar with the term conscientious objection, which is what it's normally called. And that's kind of a global term that's taken hold. That's been around since the 1960s, starting in the United Kingdom. And what it means is that doctors who personally object for religious reasons or whatever to abortion or contraception, or these days it could be medical assistance in dying, but very rarely other procedures, sometimes like organ donation, things like that. But it's these so-called contentious procedures that doctors or other healthcare workers disagree with. So they refuse to do them. And so various countries, about 70 countries in the world, have laws or regulations that allow some degree of this practice. But it doesn't work very well in terms of doctors won't refer appropriately. They won't even provide emergency care for people needing abortion. And basically, I was looking at this whole issue, and I've been working on this issue for years, especially with a colleague of mine in Europe. His name is Dr. Christian Fiala. And I didn't like the term conscientious objection, not just because it's hard to say fast, but because it's not conscientious. We feel that, you know, if you're going to become a doctor, if you're going to go into obstetrics, gynecology, or even family practice, you're going to encounter people with unwanted pregnancies, people who need an abortion, people who need contraception. And this is your job, basically. You're in part of a regulated profession. You should be providing these services to people. You know, the very, very least, you should be referring appropriately. That's kind of like the compromise position. But often this doesn't happen. And I'm really concerned about Canada, because here we have Canada is in an enviable position in many ways, because we have no abortion law. You know, we need to improve access, of course, but it's often very good in major cities. But pretty much every province allows doctors to refuse to provide care. So we've renamed it. Sorry, I should circle back here. We've renamed it belief-based care denial. And what that term means, it kind of points out that it is based on ideological beliefs, not on like clinical considerations or medical things. And it kind of points out the contradiction between here's doctors elevating their own personal interests above patient needs and interests, even though they have to take an oath and they're supposed to abide by regulations and ethical codes that do put the patient first. So they really need to leave their personal beliefs by the door. I mean, I think that the time to exercise their so-called conscientious objection is before they enter a particular field in medicine. You know, like if you can't provide abortions, then become a proctologist, you know. So it seems pretty obvious to me, and hopefully to many other people. But this is something that we've been fighting against for years, because oddly enough, even though when you tell the public about this kind of thing or other advocates, they say, of course, you know, doctors should be required to provide these services, and if they can't do it, they should get another job or whatever. But among the medical profession itself, there's quite a bit of protectionism amongst doctors, even amongst pro-choice doctors who support belief-based care denial. So that's kind of what we're up against. And we always have to fight against these objections like, well, you can't force doctors to do abortions, but that's not what it's about. It's not about forcing doctors to do anything. It's about creating disincentives for them to, you know, stop in their field or move to a different field or join another field.
So while women who enter pregnancy centers in Canada from now on will be better informed, the fight still continues to improve abortion access in Canada and to hold doctors accountable who exercise belief-based denial of care. And finally, listeners, the last clip we wanted to highlight today came from a conversation between Nick Seabrook and Louise Smith from Independent Jewish Voices Canada. Solidarity with Palestine was a huge topic of conversation this year on the podcast and on Rabble.ca. And in this interview, Smith and Seabrook outline the important work Independent Jewish Voices Canada does to advocate for peace and justice in Israel-Palestine and how all forms of oppression are connected. In this clip, Smith aims to dispel the myth that solidarity with Palestine equals anti-Semitism and criticizes the Jewish groups in Canada which tout that sentiment.
So one of the really key things that the IJV community focuses on is that there are a lot of really strong voices in the Jewish community that are invested in confusing people about anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. And the Israel lobby and funders of the Israeli state, they really want people to be so afraid of being accused of anti-Semitism that they stop protesting any of the humanitarian violations committed by the state of Israel. And we really need to make a distinction between people who are critical of Jews for being Jewish or Jewish conspiracy theories that are focused on Jewish people or perceived Jewish traits, and separate that from legitimate criticism of state decisions. And it is very normal for people to criticize state actions, state policies, and that shouldn't be any different for the state of Israel. So we felt it has been important that while the Israel lobby plays on people's fears, we need to stand against the weaponization of Jewish grief and Jewish trauma to manufacture consent for apartheid and genocide. So it's a challenge because it's really pervasive. So we've had to make sure that people are educating city councilors, provincial representatives, federal representatives. There's a ton of activity that happens at the school board level that I was completely oblivious to until I started working with IJV and really seeing how relentlessly people are lobbied to try to make any criticism of Israel perceived to be anti-Semitic. And this is really threatening to other students and teachers and parents, Palestinian families, people who are allied with Palestinians, and just generally communities that want to be able to fight racism against them. It really forces them to be so careful about how they approach that so that they don't get falsely accused of anti-Semitism. And then have professional or personal repercussions from that.
What an amazing year of guest speakers and interviews on the show. If you'd like to revisit and listen to the full version of any of these episodes, be sure to check out rabble.ca/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. And once you're done there, visit us on social media and let us know what interview stood out to you the most this year and what guest you hope to hear on Rabble Radio in the year to come. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week and this year. Thank you, as always, for tuning in all year long. I'd like to take this opportunity to mention that Rabble.ca is in the middle of our winter fundraising campaign. So if you'd like to share some care this holiday season and really want to support the work we do, please consider becoming a monthly donor or gifting a one-time donation to Rabble today by visiting rabble.ca/donate. Thank you to every single journalist, writer, activist, artist, and organizer who contributed to this year's content on Rabble.ca and on Rabble Radio. Thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And finally, the biggest thank you to you for tuning into Rabble Radio every single week this year. Rabble Radio will return on Friday, January 10th, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next year. Thank you.